ATN and Inc. versus McGarrett. Mr. Jakubowski.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Stephen Jakubowski for ATN, an Illinois company. Your Honor, I would like to start with a little bit of background so you understand the nature of the contract that was entered into and before we focus on the particular provision. This was the defendants are entities that are foreign-based, had no presence in the North American market. What they were selling and what this dispute is really about are bedpans. And as you well know, anyone who has people, either themselves or friends or relatives in the hospital, know the importance of a bedpan and the importance of it for hygiene and the importance of the absorbency of the bedpan to prevent disease. And what defendants have is a patented process for an interwoven absorbent core that when the record shows that when Mr. Azaroff from ATN met with the defendants, he had one of these oh wow experiences when he saw the absorbency of the bedpan. And so they entered into discussions with respect to their hopes and dreams, really, with respect to the development of the North American marketplace. It was reflected in, I think both parties agree, a three-step process that was embodied in this letter of intent. And it set forth a requirement to use best efforts to sell, and then there were discussions about other ramifications and potential building out of the marketplace. In Mr. Azaroff's deposition, which is in the record, and the exhibits to it, there are some prior contracts and prior drafts of this letter of intent. The first draft did not have any reference to termination. What happens if the agreement terminates? And ultimately, that became embodied in paragraph 7. What happens to the customers we bring to the table, you having had no presence in this marketplace, what happens to those customers and what rights do we have with respect to those customers? It is a natural business reaction to expectation of profit. And so paragraph 7, and what I would like to do, Your Honors, focus on pages 13 and 14 of the appendix, which is, I think, the key area that we believe there was error in the district court's opinion.
You know, your brief is really excellent here.
Thank you, Your Honor.
For framing the issue. But looking at that paragraph 7, which is what Judge Grady sort of focused on, agreed quantities, what does that mean?
Well, I think what it means, Your Honor, and what we've said it means, is that it relates to what was agreed to between the customer and ATN, not between ATN and McAirlades.
Is that what you argued at the district court?
That is what we argued, Your Honor. And what we said at the district court was that you have to look at, we framed it in the context of, for so long as the customer is buying from ATN. In other words, you look at the relationship between the customer and ATN.
I guess I understood you to be arguing at the district court that it was an exclusive dealing contract.
Right. It was exclusive, and it is an exclusive dealing contract.
That's what that provision meant.
Correct. And at page 18 of our original brief, Your Honor, at the district court level, we stated, in citing to the Robards case, that it would be the amount that corresponded to the best efforts to sell the product. And I think what's important here, Your Honor, is focusing on, and I think, excuse me, let me start again. I think what the district court failed to do was go through a careful analytical process with respect to paragraph 7. And that requires look at the language, and when we look at the language, we come up with two different interpretations. The defendants say, well, it's a separate verb clause issue, and that's a method, that's a standard contract interpretation principle. And our response to that is the case they cite on certainly doesn't turn it into a contract interpretation principle. And the separate verb clause doesn't apply here because this is a contract that was drafted by non-lawyers. One was a German, one was an Israeli. And to assume that they are familiar and experts in the principles of Strunk and White, I think, is inappropriate. And so then the question is, well, is it superfluous? And which is what the defendants say. And I don't think it is superfluous. And the reason it's not superfluous is because the language, as long as ATN buys from NewCo, is critical to the exclusivity and the requirements contract. It's critical to resolving this question of the buyer's option. Is it a requirements contract? And what we're saying, it is a requirements contract, and it's not superfluous language, because absent that language, there would be the buyer's option, and there would be no requirements contract, and the quantity would be required. So when we look at the language, I think the language is at best ambiguous, at worst ambiguous. I think it leans in our favor for the following reason, and that is you have to look at the context. And Zemko says, start with language. If it's ambiguous, look at the context. And the context of this agreement says three things. First, it says that NewCo will supply ATN. It doesn't say it will supply upon certain agreements. It says it will supply the product. It also says, most importantly in paragraph 1, that that ATN will use its best efforts and that NewCo will supply those best efforts. Where does it say that? It says it because it asks ATN to provide it with forecasts. It doesn't say to provide it with agreements, to provide it with invoices that it may approve. It says provide us with forecasts. Why? Because if you step back and look at the context, you had a new marketplace, you have a $600 million marketplace, you have a large company that's trying to develop a presence here, and in the context of that, there was no need for future negotiation with respect to quantity. Whatever ATN could sell, NewCo was going to be able to deliver. And so I think in the context of that, to expect that, as Judge Grady said, that there would be future negotiation over the terms to be agreed upon doesn't reflect the context or the expectation of the parties. Finally, Your Honor, I want to focus on the duration issue. It's something that Judge Grady did not address. He addressed it, I think, tangentially, but in the context of citing to the Majid opinion, but did not really address the issue head on. And I think that for you to make the final ruling, hopefully in our favor, I think you would need to resolve this issue of duration and whether or not duration was indefinite. Let's assume you can get over the quantity issue. Well, is it indefinite as a result of duration? And the issue there is really whether the trigger for termination is specific and objective. And I think it is here because it's not tied to something that ATN could have done itself. It was tied to what the customer does. And the customer decides it doesn't want to purchase anymore, then that's the end of the exclusivity. And I think that's in a specific, objective event that is not within the control of the parties, that falls within the cases, the Stein case, the RJN case, all the cases that say that you have to have some type of an objective event.
Was the customers of ATN, the one customer they had, is that who you're referring to?
Yes, that would be Medline, for example.
And as long as they're buying something?
As long as they are continuing to buy and want to buy from us.
Then the contract never ends.
Well, it does end, because it ends when ATN decide, when the customer says, I don't need these products anymore.
Yeah, but that could...
That's true. It could, Your Honor, and I don't disagree with that. There is an element of indefiniteness to that, and I agree with that. But I think that if you look at the cases where the Illinois courts have held that there's definiteness, for example, the Ricky case. That was the case where the plaintiff was in the Army, and the contract was, the merchant said, as long as you, the salesman, are in the Army and are not discharged from the Army, you are going to be entitled to your commission. Okay, well, he could stay in the Army for his whole life, and he could never be discharged from the Army. But the Illinois court said, even though there is that element of indefiniteness to it, it still is sufficiently definite to provide an enforceable agreement. That was the Stein case.
How do they terminate this? For instance, what if they've only got one customer, and I don't know what the volume was, but just say they're just not selling very many. They say you're not performing well enough.
To whom?
Find somebody better.
Who says to whom?
The,
I'm sorry.
The manufacturer, the one, whatever.
NUCO. Yeah. So if how does NUCO terminate it?
Yeah.
I think with respect to this customer, I think that NUCO only terminates it when it says this customer is not buying from you anymore, or you're not buying from us. You're buying from somebody else. You're buying from one of our other distributors. Let me reserve my remainder for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Mr. Diatomo?
May it please the Court, John Diatomo appearing for the defendants at appellees. The entire argument that counsel has raised here today as well as in the briefs was not raised in the lower court. And I think it makes logical sense to address the issue of waiver at the outset. The argument counsel is making is that the term agreed quantity should be interpreted to mean quantities agreed between ATN and its customers rather than quantities agreed between ATN and NUCO. That issue was not raised below. As this Court is aware, the purpose of requiring that a party raise an issue, an argument below in the trial court, is to give the opposing party an opportunity to develop evidence through discovery to support a counterargument, as well as give the district court an opportunity to rule on that specific issue. Neither one of those events occurred in this case.
Would that be waiver or forfeiture?
Either one, Judge. In our view, it wasn't raised below. It cannot be raised at this point. Judge Grady couldn't be clearer in terms of what he understood the issue to be based on the arguments made by the parties. At pages 13 and 14 of the district court opinion, Judge Grady states, quote, "The issue here is the quantity of products that ATN must purchase from NUCO in order to maintain exclusivity," end quote. Couldn't be clearer what he understood the issue to be based on the arguments of the parties. There's no suggestion in the record that Judge Grady was presented with any other argument concerning the interpretation of the term agreed quantities. It was not raised below, and it's been waived. Counsel cites in their brief a Ninth Circuit decision purportedly for the proposition that an issue directly or indirectly considered or referred to by the district court is preserved. I would note the obvious first that that's a Ninth Circuit decision. We've cited a Seventh Circuit decision for the proposition that the issue must be explicitly raised below in order to be preserved for appeal. But moreover, the quote attributed to that case, I simply don't find in that cited opinion. Even assuming the issue is not waived, this Court should reject that interpretation on the basis that it contravenes fundamental principles of contract construction. Specifically, it would render language in paragraph 7 surplusage. Specifically, the phrase, quote, "and ATN purchases the products from NUCO," end quote, would be simply unnecessary. It would be meaningless if the Court were to accept the construction and the interpretation of paragraph 7 now urged by ATN. As the Court is aware, it must give meaning and effect to every word and every clause in the agreement. And again, the construction and interpretation offered by ATN would contravene that principle. ATN has argued in its brief that that language was not meaningless, that it served rather to restrict ATN from purchasing from any other source. But the language simply doesn't do that. It does not say purchases solely from NUCO or exclusively from NUCO. So clearly that was not the intent of that phrase. Rather, the purpose was simply to introduce the latter clause, which was in the agreed quantities. I think it's a natural reading. It makes logical sense that the phrase "in the agreed quantities" refers to products to be purchased from NUCO. The fundamental point
is the amount of those products. So it's not which product, it's the amount, isn't it?
The quantities, that's right, the amount
so
of the product.
And this agreed quantities, they're only that one customer, and it could be interpreted as the customers of it's how much the customers of ATN ordered.
Well, I disagree.
This open-ended issue. What is NUCO's position on when it can terminate?
Judge, our position is it's simply not stated. It's indefinite, and that's a good question, Your Honor.
Indefinite means it doesn't go on forever, doesn't it?
Well, indefinite means it's terminable at will.
Yeah. That's your position, I presume.
Yes, Judge. The fundamental point, Your Honors, is that Paragraph 7 is too indefinite to create a binding obligation. It's indefinite both with respect to the agreed quantities, and it's indefinite with respect to the duration. And I think it's important when you're considering the issue of definiteness to look not simply at paragraph 7 of the letter of intent, but rather the entire letter of intent. It's clear looking at the letter of intent that the purpose was not simply to create a supply agreement arrangement between NUCCO and ATN. The parties were contemplating and negotiating over the course of a year a much larger, much more sophisticated transaction. Specifically, if you look at paragraph 2 of the letter of intent, the parties were considering and negotiating the sale of a converting machine that would convert the absorbent cores into finished product. If you credit the deposition testimony of one of plaintiff's witnesses, Mr. Shapiro, that piece of the deal was worth about $1 million. Additionally, paragraph 4 in the letter of intent, the parties were discussing and negotiating the installation of an entire airline manufacturing line. In other words, a facility that would actually manufacture these absorbent cores. Again, if you credit Mr. Shapiro's testimony, that piece of the deal was worth approximately $35 million. As Judge Grady noted, it's unreasonable, it's inconceivable that sophisticated business people would reduce a final agreement in a transaction of this size to really a one-and-a-half-page agreement. It's a three-page document. If you take off the last page, which is the signature block, and the first page, three-quarters of it just lists the parties. We're really talking about an agreement of nothing more than one-and-a-half pages. It would be unreasonable to conclude that the parties intended that one-and-a-half-page document to be a final agreement in a transaction of this size.
Well, as far as the manufacturing facilities, there wasn't any evidence of anything proceeding with that, is there?
There were negotiations. There were letters exchanged back and forth.
But I mean money spent for starting some project.
Not to my knowledge. So that's the fundamental point, Your Honors, is that this paragraph 7 is too indefinite to create a binding obligation. Counsel has responded that this should be interpreted as a requirements contract, and therefore there's no need to stipulate a specific quantity term in paragraph 7. Unfortunately, they cannot demonstrate the elements necessary to create a requirements contract under Seventh Circuit law. There's no language or term in the letter of intent that would impose an obligation on ATN to purchase its requirements from NUCCO, nor is there any language or provision that would require ATN to purchase its requirements exclusively from NUCCO. So they haven't satisfied the elements necessary to create a requirements contract. It's true that a requirements contract can be inferred where there's language in the agreement that would restrict the buyer from looking elsewhere for the particular product. But again, there's no language in the letter of intent that would bar ATN from going to other sources to obtain this product. So there's no express requirements contract created, and there's no implied requirements contract created. Moreover, I would point out that just the use of the term agreed quantities undermines the suggestion that this should be interpreted as a requirements contract. As the court is aware, in a requirements contract, the quantity term is the good faith requirements of the buyer. Here, the parties inserted the term agreed quantities, which suggests that the parties had in mind some fixed or set quantity. So, again, simply the use of the term agreed quantities undermines any suggestion that this is a requirements contract. The contract, paragraph 7, rather, is also indefinite with respect to duration. As Your Honor pointed out, there's no time limit or time period specified for the alleged period of exclusivity. Counsel has argued that it is not indefinite when the termination is tied to some specific objective event. And the argument they make is that the specific objective event is ATN's customers no longer purchasing from ATN. The problem with that argument is that ATN had the power to control that circumstance. ATN had the power to bring about that occurrence. There's no evidence in the record of any fixed quantity or term purchasing arrangement between ATN and its customers. If that's the case, there was nothing to stop ATN from simply deciding it no longer wanted to sell to its customers. And if that's the case, ATN had it within its power to bring about the termination of that relationship, to trigger a termination of that selling relationship. So clearly, ATN had the power to terminate that purchasing relationship. It was not tied to some specific objective event, and therefore it should be deemed terminable at will and indefinite.
Well, even if it did, if your client takes that customer as a direct customer, that's the end of the ATN selling to them, isn't it? Isn't that what happened?
Ultimately, that did. At the end of the one-year period where they had the exclusive rights to market in the United States, that's right.
So that ends their ability to perpetuate the contract.
That's true.
Based on their interpretation.
That's correct. Lastly, I would point out, counsel had argued that for some reason we should consider deposition testimony or other extrinsic evidence. I would simply point out quickly that in both the district court as well as this court, ATN has taken the position that the agreement is not ambiguous. Specifically on page six of their reply brief in this court, ATN has stated, quote, paragraph 7 is not ambiguous, end quote. Furthermore, in response to our motion for summary judgment filed in the district court, in their response to our statement of facts, and this is document 76 in the district court record, in response to both our statement of facts 13 and 14, ATN stated, quote, the agreement speaks for itself and its terms are unambiguous, end quote. So the suggestion now that there's some ambiguity in the agreement that requires extrinsic evidence to clarify is simply inconsistent with the position taken by ATN, the lower court, as well as this court. To conclude, I would adopt the reference that counsel made earlier to the letter of intent. It truly did express the hopes and dreams of the parties. It was by no means a final agreement concerning a $35 million transaction. It was simply a document. It was one step in the process of hopefully getting to a final agreement at a point in time. The agreed quantities would be stipulated in the agreement. Thank you.
Give it 2 minutes here.
Your Honor, we do not think the contract is ambiguous for all the reasons I said, but at worst, at best, it is ambiguous as to paragraph seven. So if it is ambiguous, then we know what happens. It has to be decided by a trier of fact. We don't think it's ambiguous. We think that with respect to quantity, it surely has to be the quantity between the customer and ATN for the reasons I stated. This was an open-ended, best efforts contract. We were going to supply forecasts, and we were going to base our invoices on whatever we received, whatever amounts and quantities we received. There was never, in the whole record, a single negotiation over that amount between the two parties. And I think that is also good evidence of the fact that that was never intended by the parties. I think the most important issue that you're wrestling with here, and that I think all the parties wrestle with, is this question of duration. And that's what I want to address right now. And the five cases that we cite that were cited in the briefs are the Rickey case, the Stein case, and the Commodity Merchants case, Seventh Circuit case. This Commodity Merchants case is a case that doesn't appear on its face to really be a question about duration, but at the end of the day, there are cases that actually cite the Commodity Merchants as a case where the duration term is not indefinite for the reason that it's tied to a specific and objective event. Now, in Commodities Merchants, what's happened was it was based on the unsatisfactory financial condition of Commodity Merchants, which ended up in bankruptcy, and that was the basis for the termination. And the court said that that was a valid contract termination provision. Didn't say the contract was unenforceable because it had something, because nobody knew when Commodity Merchants would have an unsatisfactory financial condition, but it said still that it was a sufficient objective event to be able to provide a duration term. Stein, we talked about. Rickey, we talked about. And Rickey, that actually had a bit of control within the party itself. And Rickey was a lease. And the termination event was tied to the lessee's option to buy out the lease. Could happen any time. There was no specific time frame, but it still was an objective event that wasn't a tie to the simple ad hoc decision to terminate or not terminate the contract. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate your time. Have a good day.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.